The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week we're discussing ideas, and how even the best of them sometimes struggle for acceptance. We'll talk to Sharon Birch McGrain about her new book on Bayes' rule, which was reviled by statisticians even while it was helping to win World War II. But first, let's find out what it takes for an idea to go from minority opinion to social consensus.
I'm here with Dr. Boleslaw Szymanski, director of the Social Cognitive Networks Academic Research Center, which is a part of the Network Science Collaborative Technology Alliance, funded by the United States Army. Thanks for being here, sir.
Pleasure.
So you were one of the people involved in a recent study out of the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute?
Yes.
When I read the abstract of this, I immediately wanted to get you on the show to talk about it. So tell us about the study.
We are very much interested how opinions spread in society. And in order to build a model which we can analyze both analytically but also through simulations, we made several abstractions. We built a social network, and the entities which live in this network, the nodes, were entities which abstract certain characteristic behavior of the human beings, but in very, very generalized way. We call this model double binary. Binary first, because we consider only two competing opinions. Entities in this network really have either opinion of majority or opinion of minority. Second, it is binary because we assume the different levels of commitment to the opinion. And really, just two levels are considered in our study now. One level of commitment is commitment for life. We called such nodes committed. Those are the nodes which would advocate opinion no matter what, and they would never change their own opinion. The second part, we call them flexibles. Those are entities which, if they encounter two interactions in the network with two other entities saying the same opinion to them, they would change opinion. So they are very flexible. They have some opinion. They hear two advocates of open-ended opinion. They would accept it. But then, of course, if they hear another two opinions, they would go back to the first one. You see how this is simplification, because all of a sudden we have only these two kind of entities sticking or not sticking to the opinion. And now we also assumed that majority holds non-committed opinions.
Right.
And minority is committed to their opinion. They deeply believe and stick to their opinion. And now we let entities in our network talk to each other under these rules. So what we discovered, that in this very simple model even, there are two different processes going on. One process happens if we have committed minority above certain tipping point. This point varies a bit in our idealization between slightly different kind of networks, whether the network is uniformly connected or maybe it's just, you know, having some nodes which are well connected and others which are not so well connected. So that would vary a bit. An exact value for ideal network, for in other words, uniform connection, is a 9.79%. So above this tipping point, what happens is a very rapid spread of minority opinion. In the time which we can describe as logarithmic in the size of the network, which is very fast, the idea would spread to the entire population. And what logarithmic means, that any new node added to the network, increasing its size, increases the time to the consensus just by one divided by the number of the nodes which are currently there. So as you see, bigger network becomes, smaller and smaller is impact of increasing its size. And it's the consensus built very, very quickly. On the other hand, if minority opinion is below tipping point, the process changes drastically. In other words, the process goes up if you look at the number of minority opinion holders which are not committed. They really never make much progress. They grow a bit, they drop a bit for a very long time. And then there is a very, very small probability that all of a sudden all the nodes would convert to minority opinion. But the time waiting for that to happen, expected time, is enormous. It grows as the exponent of the network size. What it means, that if the exponent would be 2 for simplicity, then adding one more node to the network doubles, in other words, increases the time, consensus time, by the value which it had for the entire network. So, figuratively, if you think about United States, suppose there is some enormous time to reach consensus in the United States. If you just add one person to the whole United States, 300 million people, the time would double. So 300 million people would take some time. Adding one more person would double this time. So this time grows extremely fast. So it's really, in all practical purposes, would take forever to change the opinion.
But you say that you could see this process happening in Egypt.
Yes. In essence, what we discovered, seemingly the same process, minority trying to spread the opinion, has two different behaviors depending on this size of minority. To our view, we observe very similar situation in Tunisia and Egypt. For decades, nothing was going on. In other words, there was some opposition. People were not maybe too happy about what's going on, but they didn't really ever acquire majority opinion in order to overthrow the government. For 30 years in Tunisia, almost 30 years in Egypt, there was some percolation of, you know, of displeasement, but still no progress was made. Exactly like in our model, when you have below the tipping point, nothing really changes. And then all of a sudden, in the matter of a few weeks, the government was toppled in Tunisia.
Right.
So in that sense, this would indicate that there is a chance that the mechanism which we discovered was at work here. And what really happened, that the number of committed minority increased, and an increase caused them to exceed the tipping point. Now, I would like to warn that the model of Tunisia is more difficult to analyze than our abstract model. And in fact, we do at this point research to understand processes in more complex societies. Of course, there were people, both in Egypt and Tunisia, which supported government for many reasons. Some of them could be economical. For example, they had cushy jobs. So it was not like in our case that everybody very happily, you know, after hearing evidence from 2 encounters, was embracing opposition views.
Right.
So therefore it's more of the struggle. And in this situation, we also did analysis, we are preparing a new paper. The behavior is basically similar. Above the tipping point, very fast spread. Below the tipping point, not much progress.
And I do want to clarify for people, when we're talking about the spread of ideas, what are we referring to? Spread how?
So that's very, very important to understand what the role of the network is. Network represents encounters between people in which they discuss their opinions. So network connectivity simply means that this person is willing, meeting, and discussing openly with the other person. And these interactions impact what we think about the world. So in our model, what happens is that you randomly select a speaker who then randomly selects a listener among those which have connection to this node. So the node of the connection show ability to communicate, which of course include technical mobility. We have the phone number of each other, or maybe we live next to each other on the street. But also a bit more, we don't talk to everybody which we see on the street. Some kind of social relation. I trust this person, I know this person, maybe from school, maybe from work, maybe it's my family. So clearly then, the network shows connections, social connections of people, ability to exchange opinions, and then we enforce steps in which people randomly select discussions, and the result of this discussion is an agreement on their, about, you know, their opinions. Or if they don't agree on the opinion, they start considering, if they are flexible, considering two opinions at the same time. And then the next encounter would decide what they would believe in. So the opinions here, of course, are treated relatively lightly. So as I mentioned, we already think about generalizations in which the model would be more similar to the real life, but I want to underline that this high-level abstractions is very crisp and clean, so therefore we can do full theoretical analysis to make sure, for example, there is only one tipping point, not many, that, you know, only two kinds of behavior, not three or five or ten.
Right.
So the intellectual value of this result is that it's fully analyzed, and therefore we have a guidance what happens in more complex situations. It informs us what are the underlying mechanisms which may govern real processes which would be much more complex.
Could this be a bit of post hoc rationalizing here? I guess what I'm asking is, can this be used for predictive purposes?
The model which we currently have is just too simple to do it fully predictive
right.
model. But it charts the way for more complex models. And these more complex models, of course, would go two ways. One way would be allowing more than one opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And the second way would be analyze how we commit to the opinion. So, in fact, already we are looking at the issue that, in fact, there are two factors. Each people individually differ a bit how quickly they are willing to change the opinion. Let's call them level of stubbornness. But also there is the opinion kind. You know, there are opinions which are very important to us because they define who we are. Things like religion, nation, those are the things which are not so easy to change. Like, for example, whether the cool color tomorrow is green or blue. Clearly, then, our model is abstract enough that we can represent that by providing stronger commitments to the opinions which are valid for defining who we are, maybe defining our economical well-being. We believe in, for example, certain kind of organization or which provide us with work, be it a government or industry or whatever. So clearly there are things which influence how easy we would change our point of view or opinion. And there are also consumer choices. Do I buy, you know, a red toaster or blue toaster, which are sort of very easy to change what is fashionable? Stainless steel coverage of my refrigerator or maybe white or maybe some other color. These things come with fashion and they are still influenced. If we see cool house, we think, okay, these appliances would look good, I will buy a similar one. So clearly then this could be modeled. Also then, we would get then sort of the network in which people would be not only differing by the connections, but they also would be very much differing in terms of their stubbornness or, you know, what opinions we are talking about. But even in this simple model gives some very good general guidance. For example, if we are thinking about the opinion which sort of is the result of inertia. An example would be we want to convince people that vaccination of children helps to eradicate diseases. In situations like that, when we know that rational approach would be not to try to convince entire society, but select the part of society which we can convince deeply to the idea. And this segment of society doesn't have to be large because we know it would be in the level of 10% without the opposition or 16%. Our newest results show that 16-20% is characteristic for networks in which opposition to the opinion exists. And then if we convince this part deeply, the network would do the rest of the job. Through the network, these educated individuals would spread the idea to the entire population.
This entire study is fascinating to me, and I can't wait to see what's going to be done with this. But one thing I noticed that we haven't been talking about is that your conclusion doesn't really have anything to do with how good the ideas are. how evidence-based may be.
Absolutely. That's a very, very good point. When I was talking about commitment to the ideas, because one element would be if those are very deep ingrained into our well-being, we are deeply ingrained into who we are, how we define ourselves in the world, like, for example, religion. And the third one is how well opinion is supported by facts. So clearly you're absolutely right. If there are objective facts which support one opinion, the opponent opinion may not be attractive simply because it's the wealth of evidence against them. And then, of course, in that case, the model would not work. We would take a lot of convincing by people to change my view if I think that it's, you know, well fits into my understanding of the world.
But ultimately, it's more important for people to feel and believe deeply in an idea more than it is to actually have evidence to back it up?
I would say it differently. I think that you touched a very important point. What really our study says, that not the number, but the depth of commitment to the idea is important.
Right.
So this is why if you have odds 1 against 9, 10 versus 90, you still can overcome these odds if you are infinitely committed to the idea and the others are not. So that's important. Now, what makes you committed is a very important thing. Quite often, it would be the wealth of evidence. I deeply believe, you know, that the sun would rise tomorrow because not only it rises every day, but also science tells me that this is the rotation of the earth. So it would take a lot of, you know, convincing me that that's not true because it's the whole science behind it. So for me, it's very, very important. Of course, some other people may not consider scientific evidence as convincing if it contradicts their other beliefs. So it's very, very individual. But really what counts is the commitment. And the commitment may have many sources. It could be the religion, it could be the deep belief, personal belief, it could be the science, it could be many, many other things.
I feel vaguely optimistic and also hesitant at the same time.
Yes, but I think that the important message which gives us hope is the fact that in order to commit for rational opinion, for example, the whole society, you don't even try to do it for everybody. You just educate well, for example, children. And then once they're educated, they would be advocates to their parents and to their siblings and to the world. And that way the network would take advantage, you know, of the network to convince the larger population. But then again, even in this case, it's important to remember about this tipping point. If not enough educated people about the idea is there, then the idea may not spread.
Fascinating study, sir. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much.
For links to Dr. Bolesław Szyminski, head to our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back to talk with Sharon Birch McGrain about the history of another controversial idea, Bayes' rule, after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
My guest today is Sharon Birch McGrain. She was our guest previously on the show to talk about her wonderful book, Nobel Women in Science: Their Lives, Struggles, and Momentous Discoveries. She's back today to discuss her newest work, The Theory That Would Not Die: How Bayes' Rule Cracked the Enigma Code, Hunted Down Russian Submarines, and Emerged Triumphant from 2 Centuries of Controversy. Welcome back, Sharon.
Well, thank you for having me. It's nice to be here. And isn't that a long breath to take in that subtitle?
So let's begin by talking about the gentleman who started this all, Thomas Bayes. So who was he?
Well, we know very little about him. He was a wealthy Presbyterian minister in the early 1700s. He does not belong to the Church of England, and they've been quite a persecuted minority in England at the time. He lives in a chic resort right near London and is an amateur mathematician. We really know not very much about him. We don't know his birth date. His portrait that's used all over is indubitably of somebody else. Wikipedia has his death date wrong. But we do know that in the 1740s, he comes up with his theorem in the midst of a wild religious controversy. And it's a controversy about something that's really still an issue with us today. That is, can you use the knowledge about the natural world to make rational deductions about God the Creator? Now, he would have called, instead of saying God the Creator, he would have said God the cause, God the first cause, God the primary cause. So David Hume, a Scottish philosopher, has come up in the late 1740s by saying that we can't know for certain about cause and effect. We can only know probable causes and probable effects. And that sets off this incredible issue of cause and effect. And that's what Reverend Bayes tries to deal with mathematically. And he produces what is it's kind of hard to explain almost because it's so simple. It's a simple one-line theorem that says that we can have an initial belief about something, but we have to be willing to assess its weaknesses and its strengths and where we have gaps in knowledge. So we make an initial belief and then we modify it with objective new information, and that gives us a more realistic belief.
Well, that sounds quite rational.
Well, in turn, it carries a commitment to update that belief each and every time a new piece of information arrives.
Right.
And that's what a lot of us find difficult to do.
You said a mouthful.
And he didn't believe enough in his theorem to publish it. He belonged to a circle of amateur mathematicians and they published things. But he didn't believe in it apparently enough to publish it. And he files it away in a notebook so that we know he did it at the time of David Hume's essays on probable cause and probable effect.
So mathematics was very closely tied to religion at this point then?
Well, it was very closely tied to gambling. It was a society that was just permeated with gambling. And as a dissenting minister, Bayes would have disapproved of all games and gambling in particular. But gamblers had known for a couple of generations that, well, they had been able to move from, for example, if they're playing a game of cards, they could figure out the odds that if they have a 52-card deck, what the odds were of getting an ace. They couldn't go backwards. They couldn't say, my partner just got four aces in four hands in a row. What's the probability that he's cheating? They couldn't go back to the cause of his behavior. And that was what Thomas Bayes' theorem allowed them to do for the very first time.
So was that really the tangible application for that rule at that point?
At that point, it really was, because it's part of probability. They're dealing with probabilities. What's the probability of your guess? What's the probability of each piece of new information that you're adding? And all of that was used primarily by gamblers at that point and was kind of low-class mathematics.
So you said that he put his theory away. And then somebody else found it, and that was Richard Price.
Yes, if we were speaking in the 1700s together, we would know the name Richard Price, because he wrote a book teaching North Americans about civil liberties. And he sold 60,000 copies in the 1700s. I'd be delighted if my book sold 60,000 copies. He becomes a very well-known supporter of the American and the French Revolution and a founder of the insurance industry. He goes through Bayes' papers, decides that their theorem will help prove the existence of God. He's another Presbyterian minister and amateur mathematician, so he's interested in this issue. He gets it published. Unfortunately for Bayes, he gets it published in a journal for the English gentry that few professional mathematicians would read. And no one noticed it, especially no one abroad. But by today's standards, we would call the theorem Bayes' price rule, not just Bayes' rule. It became known in the 1950s as Bayes' rule, so, you know, you can't fight that.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm on the line with Sharon Birch McGrain, award-winning journalist and author of The Theory That Would Not Die, How Bayes' Rule Cracked the Enigma Code, Hunted Down Russian Submarines, and Emerged Triumphant from Two Centuries of Controversy. Now, Richard Price did have the theory published, and then no one really did anything with it for the next few centuries. But it was rediscovered, in a sense, by Pierre-Simon Laplace.
Well, he's very famous among mathematicians. He's most known today for the Laplace transform. His father wants him to become a Catholic priest. Instead, he goes to Paris intent on becoming a professional mathematician. And in his 20s, he discovered the Bayes' rule, totally independent of Bayes. No one in France knew about Bayes' publication. And he calls it the probability of causes. And unlike Thomas Bayes, who's a wealthy amateur mathematician, Laplace has to make his way in the world. And he's the quintessential professional scientist. He would come down in today's world and fit right in. He mathematizes every science known to his era. And in the course of his career, he works over 30 years on his version of Bayes' rule. And he eventually gets it into the form that we use today. Then he actually uses it. So if there were any justice in this world, we would call it Laplace's rule. But he used it in a way that's irresistible to me. He used it to study babies. The period he's working in is the Enlightenment. And people are going out everywhere searching for facts, information about the natural world. And Laplace has to deal for the very first time with the mathematics of big numbers as all of this data pours in on him. It's nothing like what someone today deals with. But Laplace was working, you know, with an inkwell and a goose quill pen. So for him, this was a lot of data. And he develops his Bayes' rule over these years in order to deal with large data and to develop the calculating tools that mathematicians will use until the age of computers. And he's dealing with so many, his first love is astronomy. He wants to prove that Newton's law of gravitation is a real law and not just a hypothesis. So his real love is astronomy, and he's dealing with a lot of data that's 2,000 to 1,000 years old, collected by Chinese and Arabs and Chaldeans and people from where you know that the data is not all equally accurate.
Right.
So he's dealing with something that's really good for Bayes, which deals with uncertainties and gaps in information and where you have to assess your probabilities.
So why exactly was Bayes' rule so controversial?
Because the Reverend Bayes had said, you start with this guess. And he said, you start with a guess about a situation. He actually used that word guess. And he said, if you don't know enough to make it precise, just start off with 50-50. And by the time that Laplace dies in 1827, the beginning of the 19th century, scientists and mathematicians are dealing with much better data. They have much firmer numbers. And statisticians and mathematicians, scientists began to think that they could reject approximations. They didn't have to, that they could deal just with the ideal of science, which would be to have precise answers, no approximations, and objective numbers. And they go on a manic fad. There were clubs that would go out and collect these objective, precise numbers. Even women could do it.
Even women.
Disarray. Even women. And they collected, a lot of it was about the rate of murders and suicides and crimes. But some of the other famous numbers were the chest sizes of Scottish soldiers, the number of Prussian officers killed by kicking horses, the incidents of cholera victims. So they had so many of these precise objective numbers at their disposal that up-to-date statisticians rejected Bayes' rule. They thought they had enough numbers, they could judge the probability of an event according to how frequently it had occurred. So they could say it's occurred 3 times out of 4, 7 times out of 10. And eventually they become known as frequentists, and they will be the great opponents of Bayes' rule right up until a few years ago. Because they were dealing with measure uncertainties. How do we update it as information arrives? Do we have to be objective and precise? And Bayes' measure of belief and its approximations, they called it subjectivity run amok. They called it ignorance coined into science, and it smacked of astrology and alchemy. And the odd thing is that all the time that these theorists and philosophers were denouncing Bayes' rule as too subjective, people who had to make emergency decisions, who were dealing with real life, they couldn't wait for all the data, they kept right on using Bayes' rule in spite of the theoreticians' opinions.
To make reasonable decisions in an uncertain situation.
Exactly, which is what most of us do in life. So, for example, artillery officers in France and Russia and the United States aimed their fire and tested their ammunition in both world wars using Bayesian tables. And there was a big financial panic in the United States in 1907 that threatened the Bell telephone system. And that Bell telephone system survived thanks to using Bayes' rule. And while the insurance industry in the United States started workers' compensation insurance almost overnight because the state legislatures demanded it around the time of the First World War. And they did it even though no one in the U.S. knew the safety records of the businesses or the industries involved.
I want to get into a little more depth on some of those. But first, let's go to break, and we'll be right back after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we'll look at the human population of planet Earth. How fast are our numbers growing, and what do they mean for things like resources and the environment? We're joined by William Ryerson, president and founder of Population Media Center. And we'll get a lesson in how population projections are created and how reliable they are with Dr. Ronald Lee, professor in the Department of Demography at the University of California at Berkeley. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking on your local radio station or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. My guest is Sharon Birch McGrain, author of Nobel Prize Women in Science, Their Lives, Struggles, and Momentous Discoveries, and Prometheans in the Lab, Chemistry and the Making of the Modern World. We're talking about Sharon's most recent book, The Theory That Would Not Die, How Bayes' Rule Cracked the Enigma Code, Hunted Down Russian Submarines, and Emerged Triumphant from 2 Centuries of Controversy. So let's jump ahead. Now, although you did mention that there were scattered examples of people and organizations that used Bayes' rule, things really get interesting during World War II. So what was the perception of Bayes' rule at that time?
Well, by the time the war starts in 1939, Bayes' rule is just basically taboo among professional statisticians. Fortunately for the Allies, Alan Turing was not a statistician. He was a mathematician. And not only did he father the modern computer and computer science and software and artificial intelligence and the Turing machine and the Turing test, but he would also father the modern Bayesian revival. He's one of my great heroes. if we're going to talk about Turing and the war, we have to remember that during the war, England was cut off from all the agricultural produce and supplies on the continent, particularly from France, and it could feed only one in three of its residents. So it depended on convoys of unarmed merchant marine ships that would come up the coast from South America, Central America, and the United States and Canada, and would form these enormous convoys off of Halifax at the opening of the St. Lawrence River. And from there, they would try to deliver 30 million tons of food and strategic supplies each year to Great Britain. Now, Hitler thought, he said, point blank, the U-boats will win the war because they'll sink all those convoys. And Churchill wrote after the war that the U-boats were the only thing that's really scared him during the war. And in fact, those German U-boats did sink almost 3,000 Allied ships and kill more than 50,000 merchant seamen. So the German Navy ordered the U-boats around the Atlantic via radio messages that were encrypted with word scrambling machines called Enigmas. And the German Navy operated at such an extraordinarily complex Enigma code that nobody, German or British, thought that British could ever crack those codes. And that's what Turing manages to do using Bayes.
Well, how did he use Bayes?
He arrives, first of all, at Bletchley Park, the super secret center for decryption for Great Britain, just north of London, between Oxford and Cambridge. He's been working all summer by himself on trying to decode Enigma messages. He arrives at Bletchley Park on orders the very day after war is declared. He's 27. He looks 16. He's handsome and athletic. His mother sends him proper business suits to wear to work, but he wears his shabby sports coats. He has a 5 o'clock shadow, and he's going to devote 6 years of his life to decoding and decryption. Now, when he gets there, no one is working on this all-important naval Enigma code, the one that's going to protect the supply ships from U-boat attacks. Turing liked to work alone. So the fact that nobody wanted to work on them because they were thought to be impossible was good for him. And he announces, no one else is having anything to do about it, and I can have it by myself. He goes up in the loft of one of the stable rooms at Bletchley Park and stays up there through lunch and break. The other decoders work a little police system with a basket and send food and tea up to him. And a year and a half after the war had started, Turing could read those U-boat messages within an hour of their arrival at Bletchley Park. And the British could reroute the convoys safely around the subs. And for most of 1 month of the summer of 1941, when Britain was still fighting alone, not a single convoy was attacked. And he did it with Bayes. He would do basically just what the Reverend Bayes suggested. They would start out with a hunch as to what part of the message was supposed to say. They would guess a stretch of letters in the Enigma message. Then they would measure their belief in their validity using Bayesian probability. And then they would update that hunch with each little shred of a clue that would arrive. And if it worked, they identified the settings for some of the Enigma machine's wheels. And it could reduce the number of wheel settings that had to be tested from 336 to down to 38. And every hour counted to save those sailors' lives. And so it was truly remarkable. What they did was to take these little clues. They started out primarily with ones that came from the German weather ships up in the North Atlantic, because they would send out reports back to Germany that were very standard and repeated often. They'd say weather for the night or situation Eastern Channel, or there was one blessed fool that the Bletchley Park loved because he radioed every night, beacons lit as ordered. And there were other reports from British meteorologists in the Channel that would provide clues about the weather there. They knew that the most frequent letter combinations in German. Knowing those helped, and then a prisoner of war told them that the German Navy spelled out numbers, and Turing realized that the word one or ein for one or a or an for articles appeared in 90% of the Enigma messages. So they had all of these little clues that they kept adding in and in until they could finally get up to odds of 50 to 1 that they were right.
We have a question by email from Tanya.
Good.
Did Turing ever get an actual Enigma machine to work on while he was trying to break the codes?
Yes, he did. The Poles had been working on them before the war broke out. And a French Foreign Service officer goes and introduces some British decryptors to the Poles in a secret house outside of Warsaw. And the Poles, just a couple of weeks before they're invaded by Germany, give the French officer some Enigma machines, and he takes one of them to England.
So one could argue that cryptography and Enbe's rule won the war.
Well, it's certainly easy to argue that without Turing and Bayes, they would have lost.
But Churchill, he had all evidence of any cryptography use classified. And not just classified, but ultra-classified after the war.
Ultra-classified, yes. The German army eventually comes out with a super complex code based on a Lorenz machine and a whole new system of codes. And the British build the very first electronic computers to break that code. And as a matter of fact, one of the first messages that they receive after it goes operational June 1, 1944, is Hitler's message to his commanding officer at Normandy, General Rommel, saying, if there's an invasion in Normandy, don't do anything for 5 days, because that will be a diversionary feint, and the real invasion will come later. Well, the second model of the computer, they were called the Colossi, has just become operational. And it decrypted it, and the message is taken to General Eisenhower, where he and his staff are trying to decide when to launch the invasion of Normandy. It's super secret that the Allies can read German messages, that they've broken these codes. So Eisenhower can't tell his staff what's in the message, but he reads it, he hands it back to the courier who's brought it to him, and he turns to his staff and says, we invade tomorrow morning. That's June 6, 1944. And later Eisenhower will say that these decryption efforts at Bletchley Park shortened the war in Europe by 2 whole years.
But no one outside of cryptography circles then knew about how monumental a role played.
And when the war in Europe ends, Churchill makes the entire decryption effort super secret. No one can say a word that decryption, that Bayes, that Turing, that computers, anything have helped. And he orders the destruction of the Colossi computers, all except the last couple of models, because apparently Britain would use them to decode Soviet messages during the Cold War.
Right.
So all of that decryption, that intelligence, that mathematics helped save the war was verboten. No one could mention it.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm on the line with Sharon Birch McGrain, award-winning journalist and author of The Theory That Would Not Die, How Bayes' Rule Cracked the Enigma Code, Hunted Down Russian Submarines, and Emerged Triumphant from 2 Centuries of Controversy. So the next time we see a public account of Bayes' Rule, it was in insurance. So how did that happen?
Yes, the insurance actuaries, the ones who determine what our insurance bill is going to be, were the only organized opposition to frequentism after the war. Bayes' rule emerges from the war. No one knew of its successes. It emerged as suspicious as ever. When Turing's assistant gives a talk at the Royal Statistical Society about the theory, the next speaker says, well, after that nonsense. And in the United States, it's almost considered un-American, not right to use. So the insurance industry, the insurance actuaries are really unlikely heroes of Bayes' rule. They want to use the initial guess, because that's their history,
right,
of all of our accidents and illnesses and injuries and so on. And then they want to update it with things that happened that year. So they just go ahead on their merry way using Bayes in spite of being told that it's barbaric. And as a matter of fact, they use Bayes to predict the first in-air collisions of passenger jet airplanes in the 1960s. No one had thought that was possible because it had never happened before. Frequentism said you can only predict something if it's happened enough times so you can figure out how frequently it happens. Jet airplanes had never crashed before in air. So the frequentists couldn't deal with this prediction, but the Bayesians could. So the insurance industry was prepared for some mammoth crashes that occurred in the 60s and 70s.
So did this finally lead to some credibility for Bayes' rule?
Well, most of what was done in the Cold War was done by the military, and that was super secret. So in public, what you had were kind of out of the mainstream things like insurance actuaries, like paternity lawyers. What's the cause of this child? Did this man cause this child's birth? What were some of the others?
Well, there was lung cancer.
In the United States, the National Institutes of Health were just starting after the war to look at diseases like lung cancer. There were very few biostatisticians. At the time in the 50s, 60s, 70s, there were only 10 or 20 of them at all at NIH. Now we read about biostatistics in almost any newspaper. None of those biostatisticians had a PhD. One of them had a master's. The leading biostatistician had a bachelor's degree in history. His name was Jerome Kornfield, and he uses Bayes to help show that smoking cigarettes cause lung cancer and that high cholesterol causes heart attacks and strokes. And the most famous frequentist of all, a geneticist named Ronald Fisher, attacks Kornfield mercilessly, but Kornfield wins.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking about Bayes' rule with Sharon Birch McGrain, author of The Theory That Would Not Die. Let's talk about what all of this has led to. What do we use Bayes' rule for?
Almost everything in computer technology. It's just incredible. In the 1990s, all of a sudden, all the pieces fell together for Bayesians, and they had powerful, relatively inexpensive workstations that they could use. And they started getting generic off-the-shelf computer software programs that they could use. And there follows in the 90s just what they call a frenzy of activity while they attack problems that they never thought in their lives that they would be able to deal with. And now, if we order something online, if we ask for a web page, if we want our spam pornography removed from our computers, that's Bayes. It's used in computer science and artificial intelligence, machine learning, Wall Street, astronomy, physics, homeland security. Google and Microsoft both depend on it. It finds our websites. It sells songs and films. There's something that just happened that's very dramatic. Well, the Coast Guard locates shipwrecked survivors after they've floated at sea for maybe weeks. But there was a plane, an Air France Flight 447, that crashed into the South Atlantic 2 years ago with 228 aboard, and it crashed without a trace. And there was the most high-tech naval search for the wreckage and for the black boxes of that plane that has ever occurred. They were searching in an area of the Atlantic the size of Switzerland, a mountainous region like Switzerland, and they were looking for the tidbits of a plane and two black boxes, which are actually red and white. They're not black, but they're the size of shoe boxes. And they had been unable to find them for almost 2 years. Oceanographers thought they could deal with just the air currents and the water currents, but this is an area close to the equator. Everything is uncharted and very turbulent and rapidly changing, and they couldn't get anywhere. And after almost 2 years of fruitless searching, the French agency in charge of aviation safety hires some of the same people who are profiled in the book for developing bays for naval searches, hires them to try to find Flight 447. And they figure out the most probable places to look. And after an undersea search of 1 week, they find the wreckage of the plane and the black boxes. And just within a few weeks, the bodies of many of the victims have been taken back to France.
We have a question by email from Kirk.
Good.
Calculating probabilities sounds like it would be perfect for working with quantum mechanics. Has Bayes' rule been used for that?
Yes. It's used in physics or astronomy for what they call searching for a needle in a haystack problems. And physicists used it, in fact. They put many of the pieces together before the Bayesians did. As far back as the 40s, they were using some of the pieces, not all of them.
And we have a question from the chat from Gold.
Given the capabilities of today's desktop computers, how long would it take to decrypt a message encoded with an Enigma machine today?
Isn't that a wonderful question? You know, I got a lot of advice from some fabulous decryption experts. I will have to ask them that.
Wonderful. Now, when you and I spoke before the show, you stressed that the key to Bayes' rule is really the updating bit. Can you explain that?
You know, I worked on this for almost 10 years, someone figured out for me, which is kind of appalling. When I started out, I could Google the word Bayesian and get fewer than 100,000 hits. And today, I Googled Bayesian, and I got more than 12 million hits. So there's been just an incredible explosion. And it's been a revolution about how you deal with evidence, how you measure the uncertainties involved, how you update it as new information arrives, and then hopefully change minds. So the thing that kept me going was, besides these fabulous stories that are involved and these dramatic personalities, is that it's an antidote to this very dogmatic era that we're living through. And I just found it very inspirational.
Are you saying there's a lesson there, Sharon?
Well, there's an English economist who crystallized it, John Maynard Keynes. Can you put it in a nutshell? He said, when the facts change, I change my opinion. What do you do, sir? Which is so delicious, but it speaks to our condition, I think.
Very much so. And on that note, we are out of time. Sharon, as always, it is a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You can find links to Sharon Birch McCrane and her fascinating books on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. Since you're there, why not click the links to Facebook, to Twitter, or to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. One more thing. I want to take a moment to talk to Michael Cruz, paramedic in the Toronto area, blogger at Skeptic North, and the co-chair of CAS, the Committee for the Advancement of Scientific Skepticism at the Centre for Inquiry Canada. Welcome back, Michael.
Why, thank you so much for having me.
The College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario recently wrote a draft policy on non-allopathic medicine. Tell us a bit about that.
So about 2 years ago, the College of Physicians and Surgeons in Ontario, which is the regulatory body for doctors in Ontario, decided to update their policy on alternative medicine. Several jurisdictions in Canada have these policies already. And I guess because of the increased interest by the public in alternative therapies, they thought it would be a good idea to consult with several individuals and update their policy. This happened about 2 years ago, and it appears as if they consulted with many people in the alt med community, because their policy came out about 6 months ago, entitled, as you said, the Policy on Non-Allopathic or Non-Conventional Therapies in Medical Practice. Now, for those of you who don't know or are confused by the term allopathic, we were as well. So don't worry, you're not alone. Allopathy is an odd term used primarily by the alt-med community. It was coined by Samuel Hahnemann, the inventor of homeopathy back in the 18th century, as a term to counter his own term, homeopathy. Of course, this has nothing to do with modern medicine and the theory of diagnosis and the treatment of disease. So we were confused by this term, and that's why we decided to review the policy and interface with the College of Physicians and Surgeons on their new policy.
So what is the CAS position on the draft then?
After we reviewed the British Columbian and Albertan policies on alternative medicine, the policy that CPSO is now putting forward basically, as you can tell from the use of non-allopathic in the title, equates mainstream modern conventional medicine with non-conventional or alternative therapies. It sets up this sort of false equivalence between the two in an effort to support and encourage patient autonomy. Now, patient autonomy is a very good idea, and we, of course, at CAS believe in the patient's right to choose what medicine they want to put in their body and what treatments they want to opt into. Of course, the difference here is that non-conventional and alternative medical practices are, by definition, unproven. If they were proven to work, they'd be incorporated into modern medicine and they would be used in doctor's offices everywhere. So we are taking the position that the CPSO should reconsider their, first of all, their naming of the document. Allopathy is not really a term that's known in the general public and can confuse people. Sets up this false equivalence. And also to make the document much more strongly worded in favor of evidence-based practice and science-based practice, which, in fact, they do, you know, in all the other policies. They're very strong believers in this, apparently, but it's not very evident in this current document. Just to give you an example, in the document, very specifically, it says that the type of evidence, this is a quote from the actual documents, the type of evidence required will depend upon the therapeutic option in question, unquote. Now, of course, that's not what evidence-based medicine is, right? Evidence-based medicine in non-conventional or in conventional medicine requires a very strong amount of evidence to be adopted. So that standard of evidence we feel should be extended to any treatments that the physician offers, and there should be no equivocation, there should be no accommodation of non-traditional therapies if they are not proven by the standards of practice that we're used to in modern medicine.
So is CAS putting out a position paper then?
Yes, absolutely. We're actually putting in, what the great opportunity we have right now is that the college is still accepting submissions from the public to support a position or to get feedback on their draft policy. Now, the window of opportunity here is closing. September 1st, 2011 is the deadline for submissions. So as of the broadcast of this show, we'll have submitted our own evaluation of the draft policy. We'll have put it up on our website and probably released a press release at this point. And people can see that at cficanada.ca. But we would also encourage other people, especially physicians in Ontario, but also members of the public, to let the CPSO know that the standards of evidence are important and that we have to keep a high and rigorous standard when we're incorporating new treatments into the practice of physicians in Ontario. The danger of this, of course, is that if Ontario adopts these new guidelines, which when you read them are quite contradictory within the document, paying lip service to evidence-based medicine, and then at the same time saying, that's okay, you know, we're able to allow a lower standard of evidence. When you read them, you'll understand that this might spread, that other jurisdictions might see this and actually incorporate these new equivocations into their guidelines. So go to the CPSO website, go to their draft policy. At the bottom of that page, there is actually a survey that everyone can fill out, and you can add your opinion to their survey and let the CPSO know that the people of Ontario and the people who are looking to Ontario to be a leader in medicine are not going to be satisfied with a low standard of evidence in the practice of medicine in Ontario, that we require the physicians to practice evidence-based medicine and to keep their patients safe and healthy.
Thanks very much for being here, Michael.
Thank you very much. And you can check us out at cficanada.ca and give us an email at cass@cficanada.ca if you have any questions or wish to have any more of a larger discussion about this issue.
Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically. skeptically speaking, on mind reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Shell.